program book for this meeting. We had planned to speak on the topic of war and public health issues and our recommendations for the next administration, and we intended to talk about such issues as the ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, improving services for veterans, and improving, in fact, transforming our policies concerning detainees and torture and so forth. We have since, however, not to make those issues any less important, but we have since decided to take up this opportunity to talk about a broader set of issues that we have entitled in this presentation as Creating a World Without War. As I said earlier, we do not have any conflicts of interest. The human consequences of war, of course, are enormous, and we've outlined them on this slide. Death and disability, destruction of communities and culture, forced migration of populations, diversion of resources away from resources to meet both financial and human resources to meet human needs, destruction of the infrastructure of society, contamination of the environment, violation of human rights, promotion of violence. We could spend a day, if not days, just talking about these issues and then the impact of war. We're not going to do that, however, at this time. War is clearly anathema to public health, what we do as a society, as a global society, to ensure the conditions in which people can be healthy. Clearly, the resources spent on public health, medical care, education, and other human services are of much greater benefit to civilization. We believe that this is a particularly opportune period over the next several years, starting now, to address the issue of creating a world without war, to work in collaboration to create a world without war. And the reason one of the reasons we feel this is that nations are more interrelated now in many ways, and together as a humankind, we face major threats that can only be addressed by a collective response by all nations and all people, such issues as climate change, nuclear proliferation, and the global economic crisis. We believe that one way of promoting the creation of a world without war is looking at three sets of initiatives. And just parenthetically, everything we're going to present today is nothing new. But we feel that we need to create a paradigm shift in the way we think about these issues, not only to reduce war and violence in the world, but to create a world without war. The first of these series of measures can be categorized under the heading Creating a Culture of Peace, in which human needs receive high priority and that conflicts are settled by nonviolent means. The second broad area is controlling weapons and decreasing military expenditures, and in turn increasing expenditures to meet human needs. And the third broad area is improving conditions in which people live in order to address and to reduce the underlying causes of war. In addition, we believe that it's necessary to develop the popular and political will to ensure that these measures get carried out. And Dr. Seidel will say more about developing that will in just a moment or two. In this first area, and again, we could spend all day talking about what each of these would entail, and we hope that this is the first of a series of presentations to develop these issues and these measures in more detail. The first, within creating a culture of peace, we include such measures as increasing understanding and tolerance among people and nations worldwide, banning the teaching of hate, reordering priorities to effectively address human needs, strengthening international agencies and non-governmental organizations, and to help them to develop and implement ways of detecting armed conflict at an early stage, indeed the risks for imminent armed conflict, so that there can be some bilateral or international intervention to stop conflicts at an early stage and maybe intervene before conflict actually breaks out. This kind of intervention has gone on for many years. It's often done behind the scenes by people such as the former president of Finland, who recently received the Nobel Prize for his work behind the scenes in intervening and stopping conflict, armed conflict, from breaking out in those situations where imminent conflict was apparent. We feel that these kinds of efforts need to be systematized and carried out on a much greater scale to help prevent war. The second category of measures is under the heading Controlling Weapons and Decreasing Military Expenditures. we feel that much can be done to not only restrict the international arms trade, but to prevent the escape or movement of weapons in the legal arms trade, so to speak, into the illegal arms markets worldwide. Clearly, one of the things that makes war and violent conflict so widespread and is a major contributor, particularly to so many of the civil wars that are taking place in the world today, is the magnitude of the legal arms trade and the movement of weapons, huge weapons, into the illegal arms markets. The last two items here are strengthening international treaties to control chemical, biological, and especially nuclear weapons, improving the control of fissile materials, and ultimately eliminating all nuclear weapons, as Dr. Helfand was implying in his presentation, and as I said earlier, to decrease military expenditures. The third broad area is improving the conditions in which people live, to do such things as reducing poverty and socioeconomic disparities. We don't believe that all poverty in the world needs to be eliminated before war can be eliminated, but it's an important step, and clearly impoverished societies are those that are the seedbeds at least for civil wars, if not for international wars, with increased likelihood of civil wars and even international wars as the world moves into what may be a very deep economic recession. Improving the quality, accessibility, and affordability of healthcare, strengthening public health, strengthening the social safety net, and improving education and employment opportunities. In outlining this framework of what needs to be done to create a world without war, we have taken the traditional public health framework of host or hosts, agents, and environment and applied it to armed conflict, addressing host or hosts by creating a culture of peace in which human needs receive high priority and conflicts are settled by nonviolent means, addressing agents by controlling weapons and decreasing military expenditures, and third, by addressing environment by improving the conditions in which people live to reduce the underlying causes of war. Just as this framework has been successfully applied to preventing, controlling, and in some cases totally eliminating disease, we believe it can be successfully applied to creating a world without war. Now, the measures that we have outlined thus far to create a world without war, as I said before, are self-evident, perhaps. Indeed, much work is currently being done to create a culture of peace, to control weapons and reduce military expenditures, and to improve the conditions in which people live. However, to create a world without war requires the development of the popular and political will to do so, and Dr. Seidel will continue the presentation with that subject.
Let me be brief. The discussion following the final paper and the papers we've had so far requires further discussion. And therefore, I'm going to shorten what I had planned to say. Hopefully, we can have a discussion on these issues. Let me just summarize very briefly. The World Health Organization has put out a report on violence as a public health issue. It's taken them many years to arrive at such a report. They have never before discussed violence as a specific issue related to infectious disease, comparable to infectious disease and other kinds of problems. WHO defines violence of three types. They talk about self-directed violence, which is suicide. They talk about interpersonal violence, such as child abuse, elder abuse, community violence of various kinds. And finally, the kind of violence that we've been talking about, WHO calls collective violence, which includes war, terrorism, gang violence, and so on. So the issue for WHO is how to try to put together these different kinds of issues of violence and to try to talk about the ways of finding methods for lessening the way in which violence occurs in our societies. Now, what I will do is just very rapidly run through the slides that are part of this, because there's one of them I want to get to that's important. But we're talking about those issues of educating others with regard to the necessity for the end to violence, advocating for policies and programs to prevent foreign peace. Strengthening the organization and financial support, the next slide. I guess I can do that. This includes education. This includes advocating for policies and programs to prevent war and promote peace. This includes strengthening the organizations and the financial support of institutions, including civil society organizations, such as the one we've been talking about, including academic institutions and governmental and international organizations. Including specific examples like establishing a U.S. Department of Peace. We have a department that used to be called the Department of War. It was renamed the Department of Defense. Now we need to have a governmental organization to try to do that, and so on down that list. The next slide, please. And more important than all of these is a change in our understanding of the ways in which everyone can work together to get people to settle conflicts and disputes without resorting to these categories of violence. The next slide. So that we must become citizens of the world. The next slide. These are quotations from Joseph Rotblat, who was the British scientist who worked in the Manhattan Project and was the first scientist to leave the Manhattan Project because he feared that the weapon would be used rather than simply deter the Nazis from forming it. The next slide. And so with this as a background, we talk about the way in which public health workers have a long history of working to help prevent war and violence. We invite each of the members of this audience to play a role in building the institutions and the culture that produce a world without war. And the issue is how APHA can be worked on, advocate to try to be changed to make it even more of a leader, as it to a certain extent has already been, in a way to play a leadership role to end the nature of war. The next slide. Let me complete this paper by saying that in the discussion that will follow the last paper, we really want to solicit your ideas about the way in which public health workers can try to find ways to make change in a culture, a militaristic culture, a culture that uses the language of war for many topics. And if we can begin to make those changes, we will begin to create a world without war.
I'd welcome any comments or questions about this presentation and this kind of overview as to what we see need to be done to create a world without war. Are there any comments or questions? Yes, please, in the back.
I'm interested to hear what you have to say about how mental health and the realm of mental health, especially as it relates to APHA, is going to change as a result of the paradigm shift that you said needs to come about. I know in my studies I work with refugee populations in the Great Lakes region of Africa, and the biggest thing that we see is that mental health as a result of conflict and war and living in a refugee camp, it kind of continues the cycle of violence.
Yes.
So how do you see APHA addressing mental health issues in the future?
Well, very good question. We don't speak for APHA and its, you know, the leadership and the directions, but we would certainly encourage a lot of what's gone on before and needs to go on a greater scale to document and to assess the nature of the mental health problems created by war, to take action to address the mental health needs of individuals, but also of communities and indeed whole cultures that are affected by war. And a number of other issues. While Dr. Seidel and I have not developed these ideas at great length, we have talked about the fact that many wars arise out of, as you just pointed out, the cycle of violence that occurs in society or in whole cultures, even over hundreds of years, as we well know, that indeed relates to mental health. And indeed, one of the issues we have talked about a little bit but needs a lot more discussion is how leaders with mental health problems, and we could probably think of a lot of them, have led their nations into war, okay? And what needs to be done to prevent that from happening? It's not only one or two wars, but many wars, arguably, may have resulted, and may be still resulting today, from the mental health or the instable mental health or mental health disorders of leaders. And this is another important issue that needs to be addressed. I appreciate very much your mentioning the subject. It is a very important one. Thank you. We asked people to go to the microphones. Next person, please.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Sadelli. I really enjoyed your slides. One thing that really struck out was one of the bullet comments you made about expanding and enhancing the Peace Corps. And I just wanted to throw out a couple of thoughts on that, and I'd like to hear your response. I think that is something that we must look at very strongly. College trajectory, if you will, give them opportunities into using their God-given talents and working abroad or working domestically. And last year at Harper's, there was a very challenging piece called "An Army of Altruists," which looked at the altruistic reasons that so many people who are not college-bound wind up enlisting in the military. And the Navy has an ad campaign where it seems as if all they do is rescue people in New Orleans and do things like that. So I think that's something that APHA could be a great catalyst for, is expanding the opportunity for the non-Ivy League-bound students. The other thing I think is establishing some type of meaningful public health service or reserve corps. So there is an opportunity, and there are the similar financial incentives for those who are interested in engaging in that type of service without having to join the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. So those are just thoughts that I had, and I welcome any of them.
And they are superb thoughts. Thank you very much. The American Public Health Association is a nonpartisan organization, and therefore we cannot support any particular candidate. But I think I can point out properly that one of the candidates indeed has talked about the ways in which young people should be supported in joining the Peace Corps, joining other kinds of international movements. And so my hope is that if either candidate wins, that they will indeed adopt those policies. Thank you very much for your comment.
And we have time for one more brief question here.
Yeah, 2 points quickly. We really need to look at the language of public health that we use in our profession every day. If we look at the way we use terms like targeted and combating violence and declaring wars on various public health issues, we need to realize how that contributes to the culture that we want to not create. And secondly, we have a work group in maternal and child health that's specifically looking at creating a culture of peace in maternal and child health. And if you're interested, please see me or contact me. My name is Richard Aronson, A-R-O-N-S-O-N. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aronson. Thank you so much. We are once again going to need to move on because of time constraints. I'm going to ask Dr. Seidel in a moment to introduce the last presenter this afternoon. Again, welcome people staying after the session for informal conversation on any of the topics presented today. Before the last presentation, we just want to say a word about the Peace Caucus, which is the primary sponsor of this session and several other sessions at the meeting. There are materials on the table here. The Peace Caucus is engaged not only in sponsoring major sessions at this meeting every year, but a lot of work between meetings and certainly a lot of work in the policy arena. And I'm going to ask Dr. Seidel to say a little bit more about that. If you are interested in joining the Peace Caucus, see myself or Dr. Seidel or Bob Gould, would you raise your hand in the back, or Patrice Sutton? Patrice? If you open your programs of the Peace Caucus, and there are more on the side here that tell you more about the Peace Caucus and how to join.
Let me, with regard to that, point out that there's another session this afternoon sponsored by the Peace Caucus. It's called Terrorism and Public Health. It obviously relates to many of these same kinds of issues, and so we hope to see many of you there at that session. The final paper for this afternoon is a real privilege for us to introduce to this audience. First of all, I hope he will not mind, Richard Robbins is the speaker, but I hope he will not mind for my to say a word about his father. The father of Richard Robbins is Anthony Robbins. Anthony Robbins is a past president of the American Public Health Association. He had an incredible term as president, building APHA, moving it in the direction of many of these movements. And if I may, Tony, could I ask you to stand for a moment, not to take anything away from Richard, but to honor you. And now with that, I can indeed come to introduce Richard Robbins. Richard Robbins was a producer of television films, working with Peter Jennings at ABC, and had an extraordinary career doing that. He then moved into documentary filmmaking, and the documentary that he has recently produced was honored by the Academy Awards Committee by being one of the five nominees for the Oscar in documentary making. So we're honored to hear from Richard Robbins with regard to making of that documentary, what that documentary showed. And the title of the documentary is a somewhat long one, so I'm going to ask Richard at the beginning of his comments to tell us about the documentary, to tell him how it was made, and then to please give us a clip from the documentary. Richard Robbins.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I don't know that I've ever been introduced as Tony Robbins' son, but it's nice to have the opportunity. And all the times I've presented this film, I don't know that I've ever had as good an introduction as that, for those of you who know him. The film is called Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience. I think I'm going to just start by showing the clip and then say a couple of things about it afterwards, but it's the interviews you'll see are by veterans of this war in Iraq and by veterans of previous wars who've also written about their experiences, Tobias Wolff.